Homosexuality. The 10th talk in a series titled Love, Sex, and Marriage was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 31, 2005, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Tonight are more on the order of remarks than actually a lecture or a Bible study. The problem with trying to do a Bible study on homosexuality is that there's really not a whole lot to say other than to recognize that every place you turn in the scriptures, it is homosexuality is portrayed as one of the indications, one of the evidences of the brokenness of human beings and the brokenness of our sexuality. We could look at that if you want, and if you have questions about that, we can go there. I've followed the course of attitudes toward homosexuality for several decades now. Back when I was an undergraduate in college, was the first time that, in my experience, in my awareness, that there was any sort of suggestion that homosexuality was anything other than some kind of aberration. But beginning in the 1960s, you began to hear voices beginning to suggest that homosexuality was just one among several alternative normalcies, that it was just as normal as anything else for some people. I remember having been at a campus university group as an undergraduate and having a speaker come in to try to make the case that homosexuality was not considered wrong by the Bible in the biblical literature, and took us to the different passages and tried to explain that they were cultural rather than normative. And if you have questions about that, we can pursue that. But when all is said and done, to back up a little bit and review a little bit, when all is said and done, it seems to me that there's no way that we can look at the biblical perspective, the biblical framework, the biblical theology of marriage, the biblical theology of sexuality, and come to any other conclusion except that God intended, in the creation of human sexuality, God intended sexuality for marriage, and God intended marriage to be between male and female. So I mean, that's the only picture that the Bible knows, as far as I'm concerned. So if we take the Bible seriously, and if we believe that it is the Word of God, if we believe that it is speaking the truth on all subjects, including human sexuality, then the only conclusion we can come to is there's something wrong in the human heart that takes us in the direction of something like homosexuality. That's exactly what Paul argues in Romans chapter 1. He talks about the way in which mankind has rebelled against God. They have suppressed the truth. Instead of thanking God, their creator, instead of giving thanks and honoring God, their creator, they have gone their own way and tried to recreate reality and make reality their according to their own desires. And he talks about the degradation into which we have fallen. And it's in that context that he mentions explicitly homosexuality and homosexual desire. Now, why is he doing that? Not, as some people might maintain, because it's sort of the lowest point of human degradation. That's not Paul's point, I don't think. I think the reason Paul uses the example of homosexuality there is because it's the most obvious example of human degradation, not the lowest degradation. I don't think it's true that it's the lowest degradation. It's just simply wrong. There are many, many ways in which we can, in our selfishness and in our fantasy and in our imagination, desiring to escape reality as God created it and go into a world of our own making. Sexuality is one of the most important things that we try to recreate and refashion to our own purposes. But the problem is, unlike other attitudinal, characterological things that we might mess with. The problem with messing with sexuality is that you've got biology against you. And so I think what Paul is dealing with there in Romans is the biological realities that speak rather clearly and loudly to anyone who wants to pay attention to them and wants to give heed to our physiology on the one hand, and then our behavior on the other hand. And the gap, the mismatch between what we are able and willing to choose and what is clearly what God intended in his design according to natural laws, the gap between those makes it clear that we are in rebellion against God. It's not the only form of rebellion. It's not even necessarily the most grievous and most destructive form of rebellion, but it is a form of rebellion, and Paul uses that as sort of example A for human beings having rebelled against God and gone their own way. When we come to the question of why is it wrong, normally what's in our mind is, if I can't come up with a good reason for why homosexuality is wrong, or in particular homosexual marriage is wrong, then I have no right to call it wrong. But I just want to caution you in that regard that there are many things in life where we can know that something is the case without knowing why it is the case. Oftentimes our intuitions and our instincts, our intellectual intuitions, are taking in a whole lot more information than I can ever articulate to myself. I had a professor in college, a philosophy professor in college, whose every class he would try to defend incest as a perfectly valid and appropriate and moral relationship. Well, the problem with that is all of human history is against him. I mean, it is a rare culture indeed, if I understand my anthropology right, it's a rare culture indeed that would ever warrant incest. All humanity everywhere has recognized that that's an immoral relationship. And yet, if you stop to ask yourself the question, well, why should incest be wrong? It's very difficult to come up with a good, clear argument that that is altogether convincing, that you don't feel like you're making something up or that your argument is sort of contrived. So on the one hand, we know it's wrong. Every human being everywhere throughout all time has known it's wrong, and none of us know why it's wrong. Now, we can do one of two things. We can either say, because I don't know why it's wrong, forget what all mankind throughout all of time has known. I don't think they know it. Or we can realize that sometimes our intuitions and our instincts can tell us that something is the case, even when we can't come up with what we consider to be a compelling, airtight argument for why that is the case. And I think the latter is the appropriate response. And I think we have a similar case with homosexuality. I may not be able to come up with an airtight, convincing, compelling case for why homosexuality is wrong, but that it is wrong seems to me to be completely clear from nature to start with, and clear, and certainly if we believe the Bible, it's the only picture that the Bible acknowledges. Now, let me propose, however, speculate a little bit about why from the biblical perspective, homosexuality is a problem. I've already maintained, and we had lectures earlier, about the purpose of sexuality is for marriage, unlike the modern view that tries to invert those. The given is sexuality, and marriage is what we human beings invented to somehow accommodate our sexuality. From the biblical perspective, it's the other way around. The given is marriage, and sexuality is also given by God to serve the needs and purposes of marriage itself. Completely the opposite of the attitudes of modern culture. So we start, however, with the given of marriage. Male and female were created to enter into this sort of relationship that marriage is. And we talked a little bit about what it is. The marriage relationship is two people becoming one, but it's fundamentally two different people becoming one. And I think therein lies the key to understanding why homosexuality is wrong. I don't remember if I stated this in the earlier lecture, but I would argue that next to certain individual differences that we all have, that among the differences that we as individuals have, the most profound and far-reaching difference is between male and female. We are two different creatures, the man and the woman. We perceive the world differently. We think about the world differently. We react to the world differently. Not that one is any more right than the other. They are just an entirely different mode of doing life, male and female. And it runs as deep as anything goes into our humanity. I think the difference between male and female is more profoundly different than the differences between races and cultures and ethnicities. All these other things that we recognize are profound differences when we try to come together and communicate with one another and get along with one another and understand one another. As deep as culture can go, the difference between male and female, I would argue, is even deeper than that and more far-reaching than that. Marriage was intended by God, I think, to be a union, a partnership, a profound commitment between two people that are that radically different as male and female. When we suggest or propose homosexual marriage, we are proposing marriage light, marriage without some of the obstacles and difficulties and challenges that marriage as God designed it, intended it to be. Years and years, back in the 60s, I just happened to tune, I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that was right at the height of all the excitement of San Francisco becoming a kind of mecca for homosexuals. And they had a documentary on a San Francisco television station, which was really, really interesting because there was almost no commentary. It was just a camera watching male homosexuals tell their story. And it was very revealing to me, that documentary, because every one of their stories had basically the same structure to it. It was basically, I tried to relate to women and have a sexual relationship with women, and it was just too hard. They phrased it in different ways. I didn't like playing the games. That was a common theme. So they tended to denigrate the way the relationship would go, or they tended to denigrate the kinds of things that they were being called upon to do in order to really enter into and connect with a female. But in the end, every one of them, the reason that they had opted for homosexuality was it was just too hard to connect with females, and they didn't want to do that anymore. They didn't want to work that hard. I think that bears out my speculation about what God intended in marriage. God did intend marriage to be, in a sense, profoundly hard, in the sense that he intended it to be the difficult challenge of two radically, fundamentally different people coming together and choosing to respect one another across those differences, to be committed to one another across those differences, to understand one another across those differences, and so on. But, as experience shows, that's hard. That's a hard task to take on. Male homosexuality, at least, is a way to short-circuit that. I don't want that hard work, and so let me get into a relationship where I can have the sex I want without the challenge of the relationship. The other thing that was always interesting to me, back when in the initial stages of trying to make the case for homosexuality, is that the argument that was beginning to form was, A homosexual is born that way. A homosexual doesn't have a choice. Homosexuality is just one other normal alternative lifestyle. Therefore, a homosexual ought to be able to practice homosexuality. Well, notice that that's already flying in the face of everything that the Bible is teaching us about sexuality. Never anywhere in the Bible does the Bible ever take the perspective, because you are sexual, therefore don't let anyone keep you from practicing it. Don't let anyone keep you from having sex because you are sexual. I mean, the biblical perspective is, sex was created for a reason. It was created for a purpose. It was a tool that God gave me in order to, as I maintain, in order to be the language of marriage, the language by which we ratify, celebrate, and affirm our commitment to one another in marriage. It's useful for that purpose. It has that kind of meaning. But if there is no context within which to affirm a relationship because I don't have the relationship, then there's no function for sexual intimacy in my life. And the perspective the Bible takes on that then is, so don't be practicing sexual intimacy if there is no rightful purpose for it in your life. Well, all that got ignored in the discussion about homosexuality. Even if one was created homosexual, then why are they somehow exempt from the moral need to be celibate as the heterosexual Christian is supposed to be? If celibacy is what is required for an unmarried heterosexual Christian, then why is celibacy not required for a homosexual Christian? But all that got ignored in the early phases of the debate. Well, the unique challenge that we're faced with today is two things. One, the argument that got started back in the 60s has won the day culturally. Not scientifically, but culturally. Culturally, most of you probably simply take it for granted. If not at a conscious level, maybe at an unconscious level, you just take it for granted that a homosexual cannot help but be a homosexual. They were made that way. They were created that way. And the analogy that keeps getting burned into our consciousness is with something like race. They are just different and other and unfamiliar to us who are heterosexuals, just as black people are to white people or Latinos are to Anglos or whatever. It's nothing more and nothing less than a kind of ethnic difference, a kind of different lifestyle than the lifestyle that you have. And you need to get over your xenophobia and accept it. Just accept that they have a different way of living their life. That's sort of the standard line that has been completely and totally accepted by our culture. Several decades ago, I read a book by a radical lesbian feminist Marxist something or other called Exploding the Gene Myth. I highly recommend it if you can get a hold of it. I'm sure it's out of print, but if you can get a hold of it, I highly recommend it. She's hardly a Christian. She's not coming from a Christian perspective. She has none of our agenda at all in mind. But she was desperately afraid that the argument that was being made by the homosexual culture was going to backfire on them. Because they were trying to make the case that their homosexuality was genetic in origin. Oh, I didn't mention she was a geneticist by profession. They were trying to make the case that their homosexuality was genetic in origin. And her concern was, looking at Nazi Germany and many other instances in human history where an attempt is made to purify the gene pool or eliminate a group of people that are considered to be somehow not our equals, that her concern was that this would backfire on the homosexual community and eventually America would turn on them and America would decide to eliminate these genes that were causing homosexuality and get rid of them once and for all. So because she was so afraid of that, and she's very upfront about that in the book, because she was so afraid about that, she wanted to make the case as strongly as she could how it couldn't possibly be genetic, and explained genes and what genes do, what genes don't do, what role they do have, what role they don't have. And basically the bottom line is genes don't do nothing, they just make proteins. That's all genes do. And the whole idea that is accepted by our culture, that there even could be such a thing as genetic determinism, is a complete myth. It is a completely unfounded in science mythology, kind of a science fiction type mythology, rather than any kind of serious hardcore science. Another book that I've just picked up recently, which goes over some of that same ground, and as well as some other issues in the politics of homosexuality in American culture and so on. I'm only about a third of the way through it, but it's a very interesting book called Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth. This guy is a psychiatrist, trained medical doctor as well as trained as a psychiatrist. And he got interested early on because of his practice, and researched it thoroughly, and discusses the whole story of how the American Psychiatric Association finally changed in their, what's that called, the
DSM,
how they changed the classification for homosexuality in the DSM, and how that came about and why that came about and how it had nothing to do with science. It's a very interesting story. So if my recommendation would be that you educate yourself on the possibility of homosexuality being biological or genetic or having a biological basis, that you read up on that if that's of concern to you. Because, you know, I will grant you that if homosexuality is indeed biologically determined, and I do mean determined, such that we don't really have any choice in the matter. If homosexuality is biologically determined, then I think that's a challenge to the whole biblical worldview. I mean, I don't think we can have it both ways. The Bible's just flat out wrong if homosexuality is biologically determined, and we'd have to rethink everything about our faith. That's an important enough challenge that I would recommend that you study the subject. The other problem today is that it's just becoming cool. That what we're up against is an unprecedented culture of sexual adventurism and experimentation, unlike I've seen in my lifetime. I've never seen anything like this. And with that adventurism and exploration are coming all kinds of practices are being touted as something to try and something cool and something hip, and, you know, only old fuddy-duddies like me would have any problem with that. And to people of that mindset, of course, whether it's genetic or not makes no difference, because that has nothing to do with it. Of course it's a choice. It's the choice I'm making. I'm choosing to experiment with it. That was the very odd thing in my experience, is in the late 20th century, the argument was being made strong and hard as they could make it, that homosexuality was genetic. And then all of a sudden there was this burgeoning bisexual culture. All kinds of people who were all of a sudden popping up who were bisexual and identifying themselves as bisexual. Well, that wasn't part of the agenda. I mean, that wasn't part of the picture. This was supposed to be you were one or the other, and it was determined genetically. And so you have to reinterpret your biology to all of a sudden make room for large degrees of options and choices for your sexuality. And that we're actually more in the shadow of that kind of phenomenon now. So probably the bigger issue for you and the bigger question for you these days that you have to face is, to what extent is sexuality, as we have argued in this series of lectures, to what extent is it actually a tool that is defined by God, has been given a purpose by God, and should be used only for that purpose, and to what extent is it for our recreation, experimentation, and adventure? And that's going to be the biggest challenge that you as young people especially are going to face, is making that decision. Okay. I think I've said everything I want to say, but I know you probably have a ton of questions, so let me open it up for your questions.
When you said if there is a biological cause for homosexuality, that would challenge our view of biblical morality.
The biblical worldview.
Yeah, the biblical worldview. Why would biology... I'm aware of some research about a violence gene.
A what gene?
Violence gene that they think they've isolated in Eastern European culture.
He talks about that in here. He says there's an important distinction that needs to be made between direct and indirect genetic causation. As a kind of an obvious, simple example, he gives an example of a basketball player. Is there a genetic basis for being a basketball player? Absolutely. You got to be tall, agile, and fast. And so to the extent that genes do in fact control things like how agile you are, how strong you are, how tall you are, and so on, you're going to find correlations between this sort of gene structure and this sort of behavior. But what's the connection between the behavior and the gene structure? Did the basketball player not have any choice about becoming a basketball player? No, of course he had choices. But he was given genetic material that made him physiologically such that there are going to be motives and incentives for him becoming a basketball player. He talks about, I think it's probably the same gene you're talking about, the gene with the, no, I'm sorry, it may not be, but it's a gene that controls the extent and the degree to which you respond with anxiety and stress in certain environment, he had a name for it. Yeah, there you go. That was it. Fight or flight gene. Right. How'd you know? You know things. Yeah, that was it. And it's Irish and I can't remember who else, but they have a tendency to this. And there's a correlation between that and alcoholism. But what he argues is the reason for that is because alcohol it has a soothing effect on the very anxiety and stress that gene causes. But it's not that the gene makes you use alcohol, and it doesn't make you into an alcoholic, but it does set you up biologically, temperamentally, to desire that in a way that other people wouldn't desire it as strongly. So, but he says that's a secondary relationship between the gene and the behavior, and it's important to make that distinction because in our science fiction type mythology, what your typical person on the street means by genetic determinism is I'm hardwired like the computer to be a homosexual, and I don't have any choice in the matter.
The basketball analogy concerns me in that it's really artificial. Basketball was invented by athletes for athletes, so it's actually it's an artificial construct that's trying to fit something that was pre-existing. Whereas I wouldn't have a problem, personally, if I were to discover that I were genetically homosexual, I would still assume that that was immoral. Because that is, my sexuality is also part of my genetic endowment. It's part of the way God made us. And if we come into this world sinners as human beings, as opposed to the chimpanzees or guppies that aren't sinners, isn't there a physical vessel prepared to carry those traits of being a sinner, just as there's a physical vessel prepared for being a non-sinning guppy?
Have you ever seen a non-sinning guppy? Come on.
It just strikes me that God could make someone who was a sinner even predisposed to a particular type of sin, but that would not make what they're doing okay.
Right.
And that would not, for me, it wouldn't challenge my worldview at all.
Well, I think you misunderstood me. What I was dealing with was the popular mythology about genetic determinism, which I think makes no sense. It's not even coherent. But yet we believe it anyway. We believe that people just flat out don't have any choice of the matter in what they do. Well, if that's the case, then all immorality makes no sense, let alone that particular species of immorality. But that's what I'm saying, is we need to become informed about how big the gap is between genes and behavior. There's a lot of stuff in between. And it's just simply not a straightforward equation that if you have this gene, you're going to behave in this way. It just doesn't work that way. If it did, what I'm saying is, if it did, then we got to call the whole biblical worldview into question.
So when Jesus talks about the man desiring to commit adultery in his heart, and he says he's guilty, that man, as a heterosexual, has a genetic predisposition to commit adultery. And yet right there we say, well, that's immoral.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, no, I mean, to whatever extent there's a genetic component to any and every behavior, the fact that there's a choice of what we do with that makes sense out of morality. And there's no incompatibility between calling something wrong and acknowledging some sort of biological or genetic element or component to it. I don't have any problem with that. But what would be problematic is if I couldn't help myself, that my genes made it so I can't help myself, and then to impose morality on it. But what I'm saying is that's never the case.
Maybe I'm not quite understanding what you're saying, right? But I guess, what is the difference then between God giving me genes that require me to act a certain way, like that radical genetic predisposition, like it's... Like if my genes determine what I'm doing, and God just determining what I'm doing, and not, what's the difference?
I lost some of that in there.
Oh.
You got it too close.
Wait, too close or too far away?
There you go, right there.
Okay. See if I can say that again. What's the difference between me being genetically determined and divinely determined?
Oh, okay.
Since, I mean, isn't one just God indirect?
Well, genetic determinism is what I would classify as a form of natural determinism, which I think is completely incompatible with human freedom. Divine determinism is a form of transcendent determinism, which is not incompatible with human freedom.
But didn't God give me my genes?
Sorry?
Didn't God give me my genes?
Yeah.
So, if God gave me the genes that determine what I'm doing, couldn't they determine what I'm doing?
Well, they could, but they don't.
I guess since you said that would destroy everything, I'm just trying to figure out what you're saying, because you said that would ruin, or that would be incompatible with a Christian worldview.
See, there's a difference, I think, between a grizzly bear and a human being.
Yeah.
When a grizzly bear eats a camper, we may destroy it, hunt it down and destroy it, but we don't put it on trial, convict it, and execute it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet. It's coming. Because, I believe rightly, we recognize that there's this fundamental distinction between a creature that is driven by instincts and impulses, biological impulses that literally do in the end determine its actions, and a creature that actually spontaneously and freely chooses what his or her actions are going to be. We recognize a fundamental distinction between them. We are the latter, we're not the former. According to the kind of story that we are supposed to believe with respect to homosexuality, at least with respect to my homosexual orientations, they're supposed to be on the same order as the instincts of an animal. They actually dictate and determine the reality of my sexual orientation. If that were the case, then I would argue, then I can't be morally accountable for it any more than a grizzly bear is morally accountable.
So you're saying the problem is not being determined by something, but treating that as being the same as just the natural instincts of an animal or something like that?
Well, how are you using the word determined?
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, what the difference is.
In my mind, when I use the word determined, I mean necessitated.
Yeah, that's...
Okay. If my orientation is necessitated by something that doesn't involve my will, then there can be no moral culpability for it, in
right.
my view.
I agree with you.
Okay.
I'm just... I guess I still don't... I still don't see the difference between that and then saying I'm divinely determined to do what I do. I mean, I've heard you talk about it lots of times. I just...
Okay. Well, it's simply... whether or not I'm right, you'll ultimately have to decide. But I would argue that because God is a transcendent cause and not a cause, what I call an ordinary cause, within nature itself, like those things that cause the grizzly bear to do what the grizzly bear does, physics, chemistry, the complex of physics and chemistry and biology, if those are the things that are causing me to do what I'm doing, then I'm naturally determined and cannot be held morally accountable. But if the cause is a transcendent cause from outside of nature, from beyond reality itself, as I believe God is, then the logic of transcendent causation is a fundamentally different kind of logic from ordinary causation. That is, what I mean by that is, there are certain implications of my actions being caused by nature. Namely, I'm not free. There are different implications of me being caused by a transcendent cause, namely, I still am free. So, if I'm right about that, then that's why they're different. If I'm wrong about that, then I'm just making this stuff up.
I had a different sort of question or comment, I'm not sure which, but just thinking about the way, as you were saying, homosexuality is just totally accepted now in our culture. It seems similar to the way evolution was in the 20th century, just totally accepted.
Right.
And is there anything we can learn as Christians? Is there any, I don't know. I almost want to ask about what should we do, but it's hard to know what to do in this kind of situation. I mean, we look at how Christians are just, as we live in this world, and it's just basically... In regards to evolution, it's just, you're an idiot, you know, not to believe it. But over time, I mean, it seems like it's kind of not really mentioned that much in the limelight, but evolution is having some problems. And although it still seems to be, whether or not someone believes it depends on their view of whether there's a God or not, so I don't know. But there's this... get this sense, well, we should just try, kind of wait this out and see when science or whatever begins to show, or when things just break down as far as what people believe about homosexuality. But that doesn't really work either. I mean, what should we do as Christians?
Well, I don't think convincing our culture that homosexuality is immoral is the most pressing need. The most pressing need is for individuals within our culture to come to terms with their Creator. The other stuff's going to take care of itself. If they start taking God seriously, the other stuff is going to eventually sort itself out. If they're not going to take God seriously, then, I mean, why not believe in homosexuality and any number of other things? I mean, it just... The pressing need is for people to ultimately decide to bow their knee to their Creator. So that's what that's where my efforts would be focused, would be on talking to anyone who would have any desire to know the truth about who they are before their God and convince them at that level. On the other hand, rather than completely surrender the culture, I think we as Christians need to be courageous. And that is, no matter how much people are going to look at us and say, you're an idiot, you're a fool, you're a hate monger, you're bigoted, you're, and all the four-letter words that they hurl at us for, you know, who knows what reasons, we still need to lovingly, graciously, intelligently, straightforwardly say, look, this looks true to me. And what you're saying doesn't make any sense to me, and here's why it doesn't make any sense to me. And have the courage to carry that into our, all of our relationships and in whatever context we're in. And refuse to not believe that the truth is not important in any and every context. The classroom, you know, at the university, at the hospital, you know, wherever we are, just say, you know, be the guy who looks at the emperor and says, I don't think he has any clothes on. I mean, just, I'm sorry, but from where I'm standing, what you're saying doesn't make any sense. This makes a whole lot more sense to me. And have the courage to say that, even though we're going to be laughed at and looked at weird. But I just think that's part of Christian discipleship, is to have that kind of commitment to truth and that kind of courage.
Yeah, so while it looks like, it can look like, you know, this is just another evidence that, at least for now, culture just is way away from God. But on the one hand, we don't just totally despair of that. We try to know what's true for ourselves. And on the other hand, culture.
Yeah, and you put your finger on an important point. We shouldn't despair. We shouldn't fear. History is right on course. What's supposed to happen is happening. And as much as it may get pretty grim and pretty bleak in terms of the progress of the truth in our culture, if that's meant to be, that's meant to be too. I mean, in the end, God is not losing control of history. I mean, all too often in Christian culture, we don't have a big enough view of God, and so our perspective is that we need to scramble around and save the culture for God because he doesn't realize he's lost control of it, so we need to, you know, we need to go help him out. And it's very important. I mean, Christians do really stupid things when they get in that kind of frame of mind. And I think it's really important that we have enough faith and enough confidence in our Creator that we know that he's in control, and we don't need to do nothing for him that he can't do himself. We just need to be faithful, courageous, humble, intelligent about our faith. Just do that in every relationship that we've got, and let history take care of itself.
Early on, you mentioned that the difference between men and women is even more vast than the difference between perhaps the most distant cultures. Would you like to talk a little bit about the differences between men and women?
I don't think Christians should be that courageous. Oh, dear. Well, part of the problem is it's hard to define. I mean, it's easy to see it, easy. One confronts it, especially in marriage, one confronts it at a number of different levels, but actually articulating what is it that's going on here that's different is very, very difficult. And I think the attempts that get made are really clumsy. I mean, the clumsiest attempts are things like men are rational and women are emotional, or my father-in-law used to say, men are logical and women are not. But all of those are probably attempting to put a label on something that they really have identified as true, but it's just a terrible description. I mean, it doesn't even come close to capturing or rightly analyzing what the difference is all about. Because clearly women are just as capable of doing anything and everything that a man does. And men, I think, are capable of doing anything and everything that a woman does in terms of capability. It's not what we can do. It's not aptitude. It's style, approach. I called it a mode earlier. There's the male mode and the female mode of thinking and perceiving and believing and interacting and doing. But I really can't analyze it. I know it when I see it. I'm baffled and confounded by it at times, but I can't analyze it.
Reading for tomorrow, A Man and Woman.
Mm-hmm.
He is talking about that, like, he agreed with you that, like, he listed all these labels that have been put on this is what man is, this is what woman is, and basically his point was, like, in any relationship, like, a man has to be really, really faithful to his maleness, and a woman has to be really, really faithful to her femaleness in order for it to be a good relationship. And that, I don't know, somehow that just struck me as really good that he wasn't putting labels on it. And I think it's just one of those things that you have to, like, see unfolding.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like, like in astrology, like, people try to, you try to put, like, oh, this person is going to be like this because you want to organize it and you want to have it all figured out. But I think it's the same thing. Like, you can't really do that.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very similar phenomenon. That we want to control it by labeling it and defining it. But, yeah, that's a huge mistake because it's more complex than that, way too complex for that, and probably complex enough that it ultimately escapes analysis altogether. But it doesn't mean that we aren't seeing it when we're seeing it. Yeah.
Going back to the topic of homosexuality,
mm-hmm.
all this term we've been talking, well, not all this term, but often we've been talking about sexuality and how much of a drive it can be, how instinctual it is, how much we're just wired, in a sense, to desire it, pursue it, want it, and how that's natural. Its natural place is marriage, but how it's something that everybody has to struggle with, how it's also a beautiful, natural language that communicates commitment and knowing somebody, and how that is just a huge component and desire as well, to know and be known and have that kind of closeness with someone and commitment with somebody. And so it seems to me, as we talk about this topic of homosexuality and the differences and the problems that we can see if we look at the Bible, of where it just, there isn't a place for it to be accepted in the Bible. But in talking with someone who is working with homosexuality, how hard it is to get that kind of reasoning across, and how maybe even impossible that is when there's so much emotion and instinct and need and desire all just kind of tangled into this so powerful and profound human kind of expression,
mm-hmm.
that it's really hard for people who are who have experienced that and who are living with that kind of lifestyle to, you know, kind of sort out all those threads of what is my biology, what is my emotional needs, what is my sexual desires, and how that doesn't seem to feel, I mean, how it can just feel so personal to them, and how it can seem so central to their identity, just like sexual experience feels so central. I just wonder if you could say something about that, because it seems to be really easy when we look at it academically, but a huge challenge for actually an individual who might be a homosexual or feel that they have homosexual tendencies to really kind of go to kind of like lay it aside or even think about it in the terms that you're talking about.
If we remove from the equation, I'm a creature before my creator, and everything I do and everything about me needs to be done in the light of how I must honor my creator, that changes everything. So if you remove that, then all we really have is I am awash with desires and needs and longings and so on. And the most burning question is, how do I best meet them? And really such that it becomes the only burning question. And then I would argue homosexuality makes a ton of sense in the absence of the other issue, the other question. And I think that's why I think we need to really come to understand that, so that we don't, so that we as Christians who haven't dealt dealt with that personally on a deeply, intimately personal level, don't simply become truly xenophobic. You know, they're different from me. I don't understand it. I'm not going to try to understand it. Homosexuality is just a human being trying to come to terms with their sexuality. But what's been removed is any meaningful interaction with the question, but I'm a creature before my creator, and it makes a huge difference what my creator wants. So I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, I said a long time ago, as I thought about this issue, I think I can understand very easily how I could be a homosexual. If I just made a couple of fundamentally different choices about how I looked at myself and what I thought I was and what I thought I wanted, homosexuality would make a lot of sense. So I don't think it's this kind of thing. When we say that we can't relate to it at all as heterosexuals, I'm not sure we're telling ourselves the truth about it. So there's every reason to be empathetic and every reason to be compassionate and every reason to be patient. And it's not something to be feared and threatened by. It's something to be responded to with compassion. I don't know if that even got to the heart of your question, but...
Several years ago, a friend of mine got involved in a project here in Eugene that was an experimental grouping of conservative Christians and homosexual activists to see if they could find common ground. And a friend of mine was involved in that for several months. They would meet weekly, they would have topics of discussion, they would hash it through, they tried to lay out ground rules that we treat each other with respect, that we listen to each other. We don't just wait and gather ammunition and then throw rocks over the fence. And at the end of that time, they had a kind of a potluck where they could invite everybody could invite a couple of friends. And I was privileged to be at that. I was astounded at the level of clarity of communication that could take place when people were committed to caring for the other person's humanity and listening, really trying to hear what the other person was saying. And I like Francis Schaeffer's dictum that we need to both stand for the truth of God and to demonstrate the love of God at the same time. And without both of those being present, we're not going to do anybody any good.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm curious as to what you think about a couple of different things. I guess there's a question of biology in terms of I think what you're saying is based on the idea that there's this distinction between male and female, biologically speaking, and that's something which is fundamental to who we are and is pretty plain to us. But I want to ask a kind of a more subtle question, I guess, is in terms of the biological differences between men and women, there are instances where that's a gray line, as far as there are some children who are born with organs which are unclear to some extent or are blurred. And by analogy, is there, to your knowledge, cases where, well, let's put it this way, there are people who would claim, you know, it's not like I grew up and had some sort of abnormal experiences. I just kind of like the other, like the same sex, like I have an attraction towards them, which I don't have towards, you know, women or vice versa. And so their argument would be, you know, it just seems natural to me. Like, I just like this person, or this sex better than the other. Like most other people like this other. And I was curious, is that, a function of just a soul which is like torn and broken and doesn't understand himself or has trained himself in a certain direction, or is there something which is more possibly biological insofar as underlying those things? I mean, our sexuality seems to be tied to our hormones and to lots of other things, And I'm curious as to how far or to what extent one's, how one's chemical processes could affect how one feels, you know, and is it possible that someone could be wired wrongly in terms of, you know, in the way that their hormones work as opposed to even their organs, you know, what's the explanation? I mean, it gets real hard because obviously it could arise from simply a spiritual condition of desiring the wrong things, but to some extent, if there are things in our body which cause us or drive us certain ways, which there seems to be, there's that question of to what extent those things drive us. And if a person does have those or a biologically identifiable source of why they feel the way they feel, then does that justify them based upon their biology and feeling the way they feel, or should they resist that?
Well, of course, I can't answer a lot of your questions because it's out of my, you know, way out of my league, in terms of what actually is the case. But I think probably what you're asking is, from the biblical perspective, is there any problem? Is there any incompatibility with the biblical perspective if someone genetically and therefore biologically and hormonally has desires that other people don't have or inclinations to desires that other people don't have? And ultimately, my argument would be no. I mean, any more than this fight or flight gene creates a kind of anxiety and stress that is going to typically be dealt with behaviorally in a characteristic kind of hot-tempered, feisty kind of way. What would Jesus say such a person not to do? Well, they need to find a different way to deal with their stress. I mean, it's not the stress that's wrong. It's not the stress that's the problem. The problem is what choices they make in responding to it and handling it. And I would say the same thing. I mean, I don't know if it's true, but let's posit that it's true that I'm differently wired, and so I have desires or inclinations to desires that other people may not have. What do I do with that? Well, if I'm interested in being a creature who lives my life in a way that would honor my Creator, then if I can't honor my Creator by simply indulging those desires, then I don't act on them. Because that becomes an important part of my perspective. The other thing I think I need to say about that is it's very difficult to know what to do with personal testimony about their history with homosexuality. Because think about your own life. How many lies have you told yourself about yourself? I mean, I told myself a whopper for years. And I look back now with just utter and complete shame that I could deceive myself for so many years so badly. And yet, I mean, what I had done is gone back in my mind and rewritten history. It wasn't this way, it was this way, and I kept telling myself that story. Well, if I have enough reason, enough motivation for my history to be different than what it actually was, I'll find a way to tell myself that that's the way it was. So I never take it at face value when somebody says, you know, my earliest inclinations were to like boys rather than girls or whatever. I mean, it's hard for me to believe to start with because my memory doesn't start until 10 years old anyway. So, I mean, how would you know? I mean, I know I wouldn't know.
By far and away, if it's true that there are those cases, it seems highly likely that those are few and far between, just as those people who are sort of on the gray lines or, you know, in terms of their organs, you know, are in a similar way very far and few between. And I don't think that would probably justify the overwhelming sort of acceptance or sort of embracing of homosexuality, which is clearly not biological, but a decision that people make because they decide they want something else.
By the way, the genetic anomalies, he dealt with that briefly in here. That was interesting.
I'm just sitting here thinking about the whole fight or flight thing, alcoholism, homosexuality, and for me, like, I know I can definitely identify with the alcoholic sort of mindset, like totally, totally there, and the whole fight or flight thing. And I know what it is. I mean, you don't really want to be where you are, so you try to get somewhere else. And there's this guy in my one of my dance classes who, it's really sad because he like wears a lot of makeup and clothes that really don't look good on him at all, but they're like girls' clothes. And you can just, it's just very, very sad. Like, he doesn't have any, I feel like he doesn't have any sense of himself at all. Mm-hmm. And it's just desperation. Like, he needs some, he's reaching out somehow or crying out for help or something. I mean, that's not the case with all homosexuals, but, like, it's so, so sad to be in there with him because I feel like if he could embrace the fact that he is actually a man, like, that would be, I think that's what he's kind of avoiding in a way. Somehow that's hard, or it's too much responsibility, or somehow he just doesn't like that. And it just, it corresponds so perfectly to the ideas of alcoholism or all sorts of other things, because it's just too, sometimes it just feels like too much responsibility to be a human being. Mm-hmm. And you can't handle it. And I feel like telling him, like, look, I don't need you to put these clothes on. Like, if you want to be a man, like, just be a man, you know? Like, it just, I don't know, for some reason it just seems so sad, and I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's just really easy to understand how the mindset of, like, oh, I can't handle this, and for some people, maybe their being a man or being a woman is too much responsibility somehow.
Yeah. No, I think that's probably true. Wait, you're not suggesting, but... You're not suggesting that that's the explanation for homosexuality. It's just one manifestation.
Oh.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, okay. Because I would assume that it's multifaceted. Yeah. Yeah.
When I was in college, 14 years ago, 10 years ago, they taught me that there's this bell curve in nature and that all the animals, 10% of them, only have homosexual experiences, 10% only have heterosexual experiences, and the other 80% have both. Given times of crisis or whatever, they'll have both sexual experiences. And that's perfectly natural. That's the way. It's those 10% on one end and 10% on the other that are the anomaly. And that bell curve is exactly what humans are like, too. Like humans in the natural world, that the animals and humans were, you know, we have the same kind of makeup, and that it's perfectly logical that we would experience the same thing. So I wonder if you would say anything about that bell curve idea.
Well, I don't know whether they're making that up or whether there's anything true about that. My comment would be, I don't think animals have sexual experiences at all. They mate. And put the right scent on it, and a dog would mate with anything. It's not a sexual experience because there's really no relationship going on. There's no communication going on. There's not the statement being made, the celebration of this commitment that we have with each other. I mean, that's, if we're going to compare it to sexuality, human sexuality, that's sexuality. Animals don't do that. They mate. And some of them mate for life, but even then, it's not a relationship. I mean, these are little sophisticated organic robots. They're not free moral beings. So to make the comparison and to say, let's learn from maters how we human beings should be sexual is already fallacious as far as I'm concerned.
So then when Paul uses the word nature, see, I would agree with the point you just made. We tend to pick and choose for our convenience what example in nature we're going to use. Some animals eat their young.
Yeah.
So should we do that?
Or eat their mate. But only 10%.
You know, today my rooster was attacking the new chicks. You know, I'm trying to kill them. So I did away with my rooster. And so should we do that? But what does Paul mean when he uses the term nature?
In 1 Corinthians 11?
When we say nature in this discussion, we say, well, let's go out and look at the biological sciences and what they've observed. So anything that's in any field notebook anywhere, we call nature.
Yeah.
And then I say, well, then how come geese mate for life and you don't consider that the norm. Wolves mate for life and you don't consider that the norm.
Yeah. Well, I think he only actually uses the word nature a handful of times, and several of them are talking about my nature as a human being. In the one passage that comes to mind where he's actually appealing to nature to make an argument, I would argue that I mean, nature is really broad. It's what I think what we would call natural law. So read off of nature the information you need to know what God's design is. Well, one of the things that we ought to be able to read off fairly quickly is the difference between human sexuality and animal mating. So reading nature means, to start with, recognize that human sexuality is a unique phenomenon in nature. And then the question becomes, what is it for? What is its purpose? What is its function? And can we get any clues from nature about its function and its role? And I would argue he makes a great case in here for how natural heterosexual sexuality is as compared to homosexuality, just given the physiological facts. How was the body made, and what was it made for, and what would it appear if you were just to study it objectively as an engineer, looking at what it was equipped to do. How suited it is for heterosexual sex and how not suited it is for homosexual sex.
What is the name of the book and who is the author?
Homosexuality and the Politics of Truth by Jeffrey Satinover. I guess is that how you pronounce it? Okay. Thank you. See you next year.